I'm Deborah Janod with the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Okay.
And here to talk to you about E-Verify.
Okay, great.
We released this report back in June and presented it to the Legislative Audit Commission, but I'm glad that you're interested in hearing about what we learned today.
Okay. Yes.
E-Verify is a federal internet-based computer system. It's run by the Social Security Administration and by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the USCIS. That's an agency in the Department of Homeland Security. The purpose of E-Verify is to check that newly hired employees are eligible to work in the United States. And this is a federal system that's provided to employers at no cost. Based on our evaluation and an update that we've done since last June, the governor's 2008 executive order about E-Verify has been implemented. We surveyed businesses using the system and found that they were generally satisfied with E-Verify. Although there is a patchwork of federal and state mandates related to using E-Verify that can be a concern. And we also note that E-Verify is vulnerable to identity fraud. And that's a problem that's not specific to Minnesota, but is endemic to the system. So let me talk first about how E-Verify works. An employer enters information for new employees. Every new employee has to provide some information on a Form I-9, it's called. And it includes, for example, a social security number, date of birth, name, that kind of information. And the employer enters that into E-Verify. That information is compared electronically with information in the Social Security Administration and immigration databases. If there's a match on citizenship and identity and that person is work authorized, the system automatically sends the employer a notice that that new hire is authorized to work. If there isn't a match, then the employer is notified with a tentative non-confirmation or a TNC notice. When a tentative non-confirmation is issued, then the employer is obligated to inform the employee of that finding. And the employee has 8 days to contest it with the Social Security Administration or with USCIS. If they resolve the problem and, in fact, the new hire is authorized to work in the United States, then that message is sent. And if not, a final non-confirmation is issued and that new hire is supposed to be terminated. The most recent information about kind of the volume of queries that go through E-Verify is for April to June 2008.
If I can just point out to members, besides being on the screens, these slides are all in your folder, too. Thanks.
Continue. From April to June of 2008, about 1.7 million queries went to E-Verify. Of those, 96% were authorized immediately. So the vast majority of new hires are found to be authorized to work in the United States and the process is over. 4% of individuals, though, received a tentative non-confirmation. And among those, 14% eventually were authorized to work in the United States and the rest were not, and they received final non-confirmation. So why did we care about E-Verify? In 2008, Governor Pawlenty issued an executive order that said three employer groups in Minnesota have to use E-Verify. That includes state government executive branch agencies, certain state vendors with contracts with the state over $50,000, and recipients of business subsidies. Three state agencies were involved in implementing it. It's the Minnesota Management and Budget on behalf of the executive branch agencies, Department of Administration for vendors, and DEED for those businesses receiving business subsidies. As of today, executive branch agencies are using E-Verify. That is different than what we reported in June. As of last June, the executive branch was still in the midst of waiting to contract with an outside vendor to act as an intermediary between the state and the E-Verify system. And that contract had been held up for quite some time related to security concerns in the contract language. However, shortly after our report was issued, MMB signed the contract with that vendor and began to use E-Verify. For businesses in Minnesota, both the Department of Administration and Deed have processes in place, basically that businesses subject to the executive order need to self-certify that they are complying with the executive order. Neither of those two agencies does any proactive checking of businesses' compliance, and that was in agreement from 2008 with the governor's office that they would not be actively trying to enforce
what executive was order. The reason for that, if anyone could explain that.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that really this is a federal process, and it was also an issue of resources, that neither Department of Administration nor Deed had staff resources available to go out and check that businesses were actually using E-Verify. Really, the whole issue of employment verification like this is a federal issue, not a state issue.
So
that's what I know.
Oh, then it seems weird that the governor would issue an executive order if he wasn't really interested in carrying it out. Well, that's not for you to answer, obviously. Is there anyone from the governor's office here?
I'm going to speak for Brad now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, did admin advise the governor's office to issue the executive order?
Madam Chair, I'm Kent Allen from the Department of Administration. The governor's office consulted with us on some of the details after they had decided to issue the executive order. And one of the things we did discuss is what level of resources we had to apply to enforcement. And the decision was reached that, like a number of matters that we try to enforce through state contracts, we would respond on an exception basis if we heard reports of violations or if competitors came forth and said they didn't believe another business was complying. So we will check into the issue of compliance, but only on an exception basis as requested. And it's, as Ms. Genode said, it's primarily a resource issue.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Genode.
As part of our evaluation, we also conducted two surveys. We surveyed a sample of vendors with contracts with Minnesota over $50,000 in 2008. We had 217 responses to that survey. The Chamber of Commerce also helped us give a survey to chamber members, the human resource contacts, and we got a list of about 930 members of the chamber and received 206 responses. So the survey responses I'll talk about are related to those 206 chamber members and 217 vendors who have contracts with the state. From this,
out of how many vendors? What was the proportion? So the 206 chamber, 206 out of 900 and something, was that the number?
Yes.
Okay, and the state vendors?
Madam Chair, I can't remember off the top of my head. I'll look it up though in a minute.
You know, I'm not really a survey psychologist, but just even as an amateur, it would seem to me that when you're self-selecting the ones who respond, they'd be more likely to say that they would use it without a mandate than the ones who don't respond.
There may well be a response bias in there. You're correct.
Because they're obviously being asked by someone who wants them to use it. So
we had a question about whether they would use the E-Verify if not mandated, and I'll get to that in just a minute if you let me run.
All right, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Read the end of the chart.
What we did learn from the survey was that participation in E-Verify among those businesses grew between January 2008 and March 2009. The respondents told us, for example, 17% of state vendors and 22% of chamber members were actively using E-Verify as of January 2008. By March 2009, that had grown to 43% of the state vendors and 38% of the chamber members. Now, some respondents told us that they were actually registered for E-Verify, that just hadn't used it in 2009 because they didn't have new hires. So we included both those businesses who said they were registered for E-Verify and those who said they were actively using it. And when you look at those numbers combined, it was 59% of the state vendors subject to the executive order were using or registered, and 45% of the chamber members were. We asked those businesses that were actively using E-Verify what they thought about it. And as you can see, the majority, 80, 90%, said that E-Verify is easy to use, and the transition to using it went smoothly for their businesses. They were a little bit less enthusiastic on two other questions. Whether the benefits outweigh the cost. 65% of state vendors agreed or strongly agreed with that statement, and about the same proportion of chamber members did. Would the business use E-Verify without a mandate? 42% of the state vendors agreed or strongly agreed that they would use it without a mandate. Chamber members were more willing to use E-Verify with or without one. 64% agreed or strongly agreed that they would use E-Verify without a mandate. Not all of the survey respondents were pleased with E-Verify. We provided a section where they could give us comments about their experience with the system. Quite a few responded that the three-day window to use E-Verify after the date that a new hire begins is very tight, particularly for businesses that may have satellite locations and information needs to move from one place or another in the business. Another issue was the startup process. Each user of E-Verify needs to register with the system and go through a training module and some other registration activities. And quite a few respondents noted in their comments that they thought that was a pretty clunky way to get onto the system. And the last criticism was from other employers who said that what they didn't like was that time chasing down to correct a tentative non-confirmation was basically lost time for the business. So going through E-Verify really didn't have any value added or business value, and they lost time while the employee went to Social Security Administration, for example, they may have to take a day off. We also asked about the cost of participation, and this was the marginal cost. We asked them how much additional resource they needed to put into their process for using E-Verify. And as you can see, the most, over 80% of both state vendors and chamber members said there was little or no increase in resources, technology, or people needed to use E-Verify. Another issue that legislators raised with us and asked us to look into were rules of whether or not E-Verify would contribute to discrimination. And what the rules say for the system. There are a set of rules. I can show you. That give employers instructions. It's table 9 on page 22 of your report is the entire list. But some examples of these rules to prevent discrimination include that E-Verify must be used for all new hires, not selectively, and that employers can take no adverse action while an employee contests the tentative non-confirmation. So if I got a tentative non-confirmation and all of the other new hires are going to a two-day orientation to begin work, I must be allowed to go to that orientation with them, even though this non-confirmation hasn't been resolved yet. The USCIS has acknowledged in a variety of venues that there is substantial noncompliance among employers nationwide with the non-discrimination provisions. For example, For example, about one-third of employers that were surveyed for an evaluation of E-Verify, a third of those employers said they used E-Verify to screen job applicants rather than waiting till a new hire's first day of work. 22% restricted the work assignments of employees who received tentative non-confirmations, and 16% delayed new employee training for those receiving tentative non-confirmations. This was a really hard issue for us to grab onto here in Minnesota. I did call the Department of Human Rights and ask if there had been complaints received from any employees in Minnesota, either state government employees or private sector, and the answer to that was no. We did ask the implementing agencies whether they provided specific training to the businesses subject to the executive order on the non-discrimination provisions of E-Verify, and they do not. However, a majority of the businesses we surveyed said that they did specifically have trained their human resources people who use the system in the anti-discrimination provisions. Another issue that we looked into was how Minnesota plays out nationally. And are there other states out there that have mandates about E-Verify? And in fact, there are 15 states, including Minnesota, that have some kind of E-Verify law or executive order. It was hard for us to tell how many businesses in Minnesota actually have to comply in other states. We had a lot of don't know responses regarding that question on our survey, but a few, 5-7% of businesses said that other state mandates did indeed apply to them. If you'd like some additional information, Appendix C in the report at the back lists some details about those other states' requirements. On the federal level, the president, President Bush, issued an executive order requiring that federal contractors have to use E-Verify if they meet certain requirements. That federal executive order went into place went into effect last year. Roughly a third of the state vendors we surveyed said that they would be covered by that federal mandate. Minnesota's order, however, differs from that federal mandate. For in particular, our threshold in Minnesota is vendors who have contracts over $50,000. For federal contracts, that threshold is $100,000. Federal government excludes contracts for commercially available off-the-shelf products, and Minnesota's executive order does not include that exclusion. And finally, they also differ in coverage of subcontractors. The federal order applies to subcontractors with contracts over $3,000, and Minnesota has no subcontractor threshold at all. So in our report, we recommended that the governor consider conforming the terms of Minnesota's executive order to that for federal contractors in order to ease some burden on businesses so they didn't have to comply on under two different venues. We also recommended to the state agencies that they help make federal training and other resources available to Minnesota businesses. We know that even though this is a federal program, if we're going to mandate its use in Minnesota, we thought the agencies should go to at least some effort to provide training to those businesses required to use the system. I called this week to find out what's happened since we released the report last June. And the recommendation to conform Minnesota's executive order to the federal mandate was not implemented. The reason is that existing processes for vendors to certify compliance with the executive order in Minnesota seems to be working well, according to the Department of Administration. And Minnesota's standard, because that dollar threshold is lower, will cover more of the state's vendors. So the governor and Department of Administration are basically keeping the Minnesota process the way that it is. They also then, because of that decision, decided not to bring federal training into Minnesota for state vendors. The administration didn't want to make things confusing for businesses by having training for two different processes that were both coming, you know, via the state government. So they are continuing their information about Minnesota's requirements under our executive order that's available via their website and any their department staff who can answer questions. Department of Employment and Economic Development told me yesterday that as part of a revamping of their website late last year, they've included more information and hopefully more readily, easily used information about complying with verifying eligibility requirements at the federal level. So they hopefully are getting that out to new businesses and also through their website for managing a business. The last thing that we were asked to take a look at was to summarize information available from the federal level about how accurate E-Verify is. There's no information specific to Minnesota, so what I'm presenting here are data from a report that was issued in just December 2009 of the most recent evaluation of E-Verify. And in it, it was done by Westat Consulting Group. Westat reported that 93.8% of the new hires that were run through the E-Verify system between September 2007 and June 2008 were truly authorized workers. 6.2%, their true authorization status was not authorized to work in the United States. So how well did E-Verify get that information? So did E-Verify make the right call? And the answer is 96% of initial E-Verify responses were correct. So of all of the new hires that went through the system during that time period, 93.1% were authorized workers who were found to be authorized right off the bat. In addition, the system said that 2.9% of all new hires were unauthorized workers, and they were actually found to be unauthorized. So these are both correct responses, and that accounted for about 96% of the new hires that went through. 4%, though, of the E-Verify responses were wrong. And what do we know about those? Less than 1% of cases, authorized workers were not found to be authorized initially. Okay, so that's a pretty small proportion. The bigger problem area were unauthorized workers that E-Verify said could actually work in the United States. And the problem there is identity theft. The E-Verify doesn't pick up on certain kinds of identity theft. In particular, identity theft that occurs when someone borrows, steals, or buys a real person's identity. E-Verify simply...
Representative Downey has a question.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's relevant to the point there. So unless the employee or somebody challenges the unauthorized return from E-Verify, we wouldn't necessarily find out if the unauthorized was inaccurate. So are we possibly overstating the accuracy of that unauthorized category there?
Madam Chair, Representative Duffy, I'm not sure. This is a new methodology that Westat used. And I got this report about a week ago and haven't read through all of the detailed methodology. It was hypothesized for years that there was a large group of unauthorized workers that were successfully navigating E-Verify because they had bought regular identities. This is the first time that an estimate has been made of how big that problem is. And that's it's this federal information. That's all that I know about it at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about to the identity fraud. You said you followed up with the departments this week. Did you talk to them about what changes have been implemented to protect people in the businesses against, more the people against identity theft?
Madam Chair, Representative, I did not receive any new information in that regard.
Representative Githmon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to, I know you're not finished yet, so I'm a little reluctant to just jump in, but I see that we are really quite close here. So what you're saying is that due to identity theft, either that they can be incorrectly authorized due to identity theft, correct? But you're not quite sure just how much? Or have you been able to gather that statistic of how many are authorized due to identity theft?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, all I know is the federal result here that you see on the screen, that Westat Consulting estimated that of all of the new hires that went through the system between June, let me go back to my dates here, all of the new hires that went through from September 2007 from June 2008, they estimated that 3.3% of those new hires were not should not be authorized to work in the United States, but the system said they were. And the explanation, the most reasonable explanation, is that identity theft is the issue underlying those numbers. That's pretty much the common wisdom from General Accounting Office, the Government Accountability Office, and from Westat as well.
Madam Chair, I would just add to this, though. I mean, I think we understand in terms of the methodology. I mean, it would require a considerable amount of investigation on the part of someone to determine whether or not the documents that were used were in fact fraudulent. I don't think that was within the purview of what the organization was doing. I think that would take a considerable amount of not only investigative effort but authority to track down people, examine those documents, and make a determination as to their validity. But I think it's a very interesting and legitimate thing that at some point somebody probably wants to do.
Madam Chair, just to follow up. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with that. I was just asking to just check, just in case it might be there. But many times in this kind of situation, you get information like this, and then the next step is to do that, and I didn't have an expectation, just kind of checking. The other area, though, that I have a concern about is unauthorizations that came back, and is there any information, not an expectation, is there any information that determines that when they were falsely not authorized, non-confirmations, is this just a pointing up an issue here? I have down that there were 14% of tentative non-confirmations, 8,500, that should have been authorized but weren't. So this is on the other side of the issue. Any more information on why were they or anything else like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, my understanding is there are a couple of main reasons for that group receiving an erroneous tentative non-confirmation. One of the biggest is a name change that never got registered with the Social Security Administration, particularly women who got married and never told Social Security that happened. Another issue that they're doing better, I think, working on are U.S. citizens who were born abroad. Was a small group that, because of the way the data matching was done, there was more difficulty identifying them as legally authorized. But last year, E-Verify started using passport data, and that issue has been declining, apparently. So I would say, based on what I've done in the reading of the federal reviews of this, it's really the SSN, lack of match between name and SSN.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And isn't it reasonable to expect that the longer period of time this system is used, these identity theft percentages should go down? In other words, say if somebody stole the identity of John Smith, bad example, but and that particular John Smith had been working for the real John Smith had been working for a corporation for 20 years, wasn't applying in the system, never came anywhere near E-Verify, that in fact that employment could hold for as long as the real John Smith never interacted or interfaced with the E-Verify system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hopper, that is correct. Right now, though, very few, the number of new hires from the United States that actually go through E-Verify is very, very small right now. It's a very small percentage of all new hires. So it may be a while for your scenario to actually take effect.
Okay, but I, you know, the feedback, I mean, that I've got from businesses is prior to having this system available, they were responsible for reviewing documents that came in their HR office. And they, as laymen, had no expertise and always felt a little vulnerable in trying to decide, is this a valid driver's license? Is this a valid birth certificate? Is this a valid Social Security card? Whatever. And so they like this because then it takes it off them. They can say, well, we used E-Verify, put in the numbers that were on the piece of paper, even if the piece of paper looked a little shady because they weren't experts in documents to know whether or not it was good. They like that peace of mind.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, we heard the same thing, that E-Verify is pretty good at finding new hires who are using fabricated fake documents. The system's good at that, and it provides an easy way for an employer to say to the new hire, I have to terminate you. I mean, the system tells me, and it takes a little bit of the personal responsibility off of that employer, that they can say, E-Verify has given us this information, and here's what we need to do. So that's the kind of identity problem that the system is very good at picking up.
But they do, I think for clarification purposes, there is a process to allow that employee to rectify, or, I mean, it's not these tentative non, there's the employee gets to go through the process before the employer, generally, if they're following the rules,
correct,
before they would terminate the new hire.
Is there a court case somewhere about E-Verify? You've heard that, something about that.
Madam Chair, there was a suit, I believe it was in Arizona, that they had a very encompassing executive order saying that every business in the state had to use E-Verify, and there was a lawsuit about that. But I believe that their executive order was upheld. There was another lawsuit in Illinois, because in Illinois, they prohibited employers from using E-Verify, and that was overturned. There was one last thing, okay, Madam Chair, that we wanted to mention, that we do have a follow-up review underway regarding Minnesota Management and Budget's relationship with its E-Verify vendor called Lookout Services. As I said, they contracted with this vendor last July, and users, state employees, discovered in October potential security weakness or breach in Lookout Services systems that allowed access to private data. And we are looking into that issue. At two questions. Did Minnesota Management and Budget adequately understand and resolve the security concerns they had about Lookout before they signed the contract? And then after these incidents, did the department respond appropriately when they learned about this potential security breach? So we have that work ongoing now and expect to have a report ready. Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, probably 3 to 4 weeks, I would think, based on what I know now and what we need to do from now until we can go through all of our interviews and document reviews and the protocols that we need to go through to issue a report.
Okay. Madam Chair, to that point, given the recent law that made the state notify individuals if there'd been a breach of security of their data, would, because MMB was contracting with Lookout Services, would that same notification standard apply in this instance?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, and that notification was given. And we have a copy of it, and it's part of what we're reviewing in terms of the adequacy of it and the basis for it.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Representative Kiplin?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in going through your slides, and I had a number of questions, and one of them was on the identity theft. Do you know what happens? You know, 3.3% is a lot. That is really a lot. And so how do they follow up when they, I mean, do they notify? I mean, it's really a hard thing to even know if your identity's been stolen. I mean, it's not that easy to do. But when you catch the fact that someone is using it, what happens? Do you know when they do suspect that or deal with that?
An employer, Madam Chair, Representative Fitchmeyer, an employer can ask for help from USCIS if they believe that identity theft has occurred. The numbers that I presented to you are based on some sampling. They followed up to actually find the true authorization status of people. So it's an estimate of what that problem is. But on a day-to-day basis for employers, if I, an employee, new hire, who has stolen somebody else's identity, provides my information, that's going to go through E-Verify, and I'm likely to be authorized to work, and the employer will still never know. So I would say that right now, when you look at that group in the red box of unauthorized workers who are still getting through the system, most of them are probably not being identified on a day-to-day basis yet. That estimate was created using some social science methodology.
Okay. Anyone else?
Thank
you very much. As usual, exceptional job.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Nobles found the answer to your very first question, which was...
which I've already forgotten.
The denominator for our survey, we surveyed 217 vendors.
Oh, okay.
We selected them from a list of 1,424.
Okay, so they were selected, but the ones that...
Yes. And Madam Chair, I also wanted to note that we did offer confidentiality to those survey respondents so that they would be candid in their responses.
And that kind of, Madam Chair, goes to your point about the potential for selection bias. I think when you do offer confidentiality to someone who might be otherwise not inclined to tell you something that they've done wrong, it helps.
Except when you're looking at identity collection and so forth, how do they believe that you're...
Because that we quote, that we will actually maintain the confidentiality?
Yeah.
Because we quote the law,
And
we explain to them that we would bear penalties if we disclosed non-public data, and they believe us.
Oh. Okay. Okay, anyone else? Okay, again, thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Ferkel.
Good afternoon, I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor in the Financial Audit Division side of our office. And we're here this afternoon to talk about the results of two of our audit reports. We met with you on Tuesday and talked about our report on internal control and the financial reporting process. These two reports were done by our IT audit unit. They are of two large systems within state government, the first one having to do with the system that provides and monitors and controls the unemployment process for the state of Minnesota, the unemployment disbursements. And the other one has to do with the payroll system, the payroll and personnel system used within state government for all payments to state employees. So when we do an IT audit, what we're looking at is security over these systems and over the data that these systems collect and protect. And I have with me here Carolyn Engstrom. She was the audit supervisor on that audit. She'd like to present to you the results of the audit.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Carolyn Engstrom, and I am an IT audit coordinator in the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I personally was the lead auditor on the UI program, and I will be presenting on behalf of my colleagues for the Semaphore audit. Madam Chair, since I will be presenting both, what is your preference? Would you like me to first do the deed audit and then break, or would you like me to present both of the reports at the same time?
Let's do the data one first.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, so one of the things that I wanted to do before we go into the particular findings on the UI report, I wanted to provide a little bit of an insight as to what are the procedures that we perform, what are the controls that we are looking for. It provides a little bit of a context when reviewing the results of our work. If you'll notice on page 4 in our methodology section, we cite that the criteria that we're, one of the criteria we look at is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. This agency operates underneath the Commerce Department, and they have authority granted to them by the Federal Information Systems Management Act of 2002. They publish compulsory standards, which are called FIPS, the Federal Information Processing Standards, but they also publish guidelines. These are not compulsory. And one of the guidelines that we use as criteria in our audits is Special Publication 853, which is the recommended security controls for federal information systems. And I wanted to speak to that a little bit because frequently when we go into agencies, they haven't established their own criteria for a security program. So we have adopted this, since this is the standard that is being addressed by the federal government, we adopt these criteria when we are performing our audit because a number of these financial systems are developed using federal monies or they process federal monies. So it also provides a consistency among our audits and the criteria that we're looking at. What I wanted to talk a little bit about is the nature of those controls that we look at. They're a overall security program, so how does the agency define exactly what their security requirements are? These could be roles and responsibilities, policies and procedures, inventories of information systems, hardware, software, etc. The other section that we looked at is the risk assessment process. How do they identify the risks in their system? How do they assess them, mitigate them, and monitor them? We frequently, well, all those are what we call common controls. Those might cross, they might be across systems. This is the program as a whole. But on the specific devices and technology that we look at access controls. So how do they determine who should access the device? What are their password requirements? Frequently, this is a finding in our audit reports. We look at their configuration. How is the different devices, how are they configured, and how do they know that that's in line with the risk assessment processes? Finally, how do they make changes to the configurations so that they make sure that they're not making their systems less secure, they're actually making them more secure, or at least no change to their security profile. Finally, we look at logging. So if the controls that I've just identified fail, how would they be notified, or how would they identify a control failure within their system? And then the different devices we look at, obviously the firewall is the first line of defense between all data that's maintained at an agency at the state of Minnesota and the outside world. Then they have some internal networking devices. This controls the flow of traffic between their internal resources within the agency itself. Then we look at servers, and these are the devices that hold the data, so we look at how those operating systems have been configured. And finally, we look at the database level controls. So this is where the data actually resides. Now I'll talk about our findings about the Department of Employer and Economic Development and specifically the UI program. If you would look on page 5, this gives an overview of some of the information about the department. Basically, the UI application contains information on every citizen employed at the state of Minnesota. This contains their wage information because it needs to be calculated in the unemployment insurance calculation. It contains additional information on applicants, so if you apply for unemployment insurance, whether or not you've been accepted or your application has been denied, and also the recipients, the people that have applied and been and their application has been accepted. The department itself has 1,600 employees, 3,000 laptops, desktops that they support, and 300 servers. They provide some support to other state agencies, for example, like the Department of Tourism, providing They're providing a service with high availability requirements. Obviously, the UI system in this economic environment is extremely highly desirable. This is a custom-developed application built under a contract with an outside party, Bearing Point, so it is a custom application for the state of Minnesota. Now I'd like to go into the detailed findings, and I'm not going to go over every detail, just the very big highlights of each finding. Finding one on page 5, this has been dubbed finding one by our office because it's frequently the first finding in almost any IT report that we've published here at the state of Minnesota. It's in regards to how agencies structure their security program overall. It's frequently it is the root cause of subsequent findings in the report. Usually it is because the agency has not defined their requirements, they have not established criteria, and therefore we have had to use NIST as a substitute criteria.
If I can butt in for a minute right here, do you ever ask the question of how much the departments get to implement this without the help of OET? Is that a question
Madam Chair, this is a case where agencies, as authorizing officials of their own system, should be able to submit or have requirements for their security department. They do interface with OET on statewide initiatives, yes, and we get an understanding of that. But they would still be required for implementing security requirements within their agency.
But, I understand that. But should there also, what you said was that this is the finding that you have on every IT analysis that you do, shouldn't at some point we say that there's got to be more involvement of OET maybe in signing off on them if this is a persistent problem? Shouldn't somebody who knows something about this be looking at it? If every department, it may have been an exaggeration. I don't know if you said almost every or whatever, but.
Madam Chair, if I may, obviously we haven't done an IT audit in every department, so we're narrowing that statement down to the ones that we have done IT audits in. And this is an issue that certainly gets discussed, and it's a little bit similar to what we see with the internal control discussion that we had on Tuesday and the involvement of MMB in the development and documentation and design of controls at agencies. You know, each of these agencies that we look at, their system, I mean, the UI system has its own structure, architecture, its own, you know, set of risks and controls, and it's those people and what that system needs to do, what kind of data does that system collect. It's within the Department of Employment and Economic Development that they need to determine what are the risks created by the system. Certainly we think that, and we think that OET is on track to provide guidance, perhaps a set standard for the state on what security policy should be followed, how they should be structured. But absent that, or as that's being developed, we believe each agency has the responsibility for their systems to get that design done.
Madam Chair, may I just add one point? Because we've had this discussion a fair amount with this committee, and I would just echo what Ms. Ferkel just said, but add that when we go in and do these IT audits, we have people from OET as a part of that. We think it is very important that people at OET become aware of the kinds of issues that we're finding. And they don't literally become a part of our audit team, but we welcome their presence throughout the audit. They're at the entry conference, they're at the exit conference, and they play an active part in coming to understand the sort of issues that we're finding on a department-by-department basis, because even though each department needs to take responsibility, we do see systemic problems, as was just pointed out, throughout state government. We do have repeat findings, and that concerns us, and we think that there needs to be a more active part, and I think there is a more active part by OET in trying to get systemic solutions. And I know that OET is in the audience, Mr. Boozy is here, and he can certainly speak to that. But we think that they can play a role in terms of assistance, expertise, but also, as I've said in the past, we think at some point OET really needs to say, what are the rules that have to be followed? What are the expectations? If you in state government are going to build and operate IT systems, these are the expectations and standards that you have to meet. So, Madam Chair, OET is very much a part of the work that we are doing, and we welcome that.
Well, you know, looking at Chapter 16E, 16E.01, Subdivision 3, A14, which is the duties of the office, one of the duties of the office is ensure the overall security of the state's information and technology systems and services. Now, I don't know what overall means, but shouldn't we be charging OET with malfeasance?
Madam Chair, I think, and again, they're here and they can speak for themselves. I'm sure that they will tell you that it's hard with the resources that they have to meet that mandate. If I could just briefly go back to the issue about our special review of the contract that MMB had with Outlook Services. One of the very specific things we're looking at is the degree to which the Department of Management and Budget utilized the expertise of OET in the initial vetting of that company and its security, and the degree to which OET was alerted and involved once there was a known or at least alleged and suspected security breach. So, Madam Chair, I think you're hitting on something that is very important to us. And I think we agree that there is definitely a role, an important role, for OET in addressing these issues. But, again, they can speak for themselves, and they'll tell you what a lot of us probably tell you. You can give us mandates, but we only have so many people to fulfill them. Yeah. And state government is very large, has a lot of very complex IT systems, and for OET to be involved in everyone would probably be rather difficult and challenging.
I guess as I recall, and I always get confused if I'm recalling what used to happen in the past and what happens now, doesn't OET get a certain amount of its funding directly from the agencies for, or don't they have the ability to bill agencies for what they do for them or not? I thought there was, you know, one of the things that we always worried about was that we had to give them a general appropriation for things that couldn't legitimately be billed back to an agency. And I guess we probably, in terms of efficiency, want to let you guys finish and then get OET up.
Madam Chair and members, to continue with finding two, which is on page 7. This is a very important finding because regarding your question, is OET trying to fulfill its obligation to provide security to the state of Minnesota as a whole, they've purchased a vulnerability scanning tool. And the agency had that tool, had it implemented, had it set up, but at the time of the audit was actually not actively using it. So this was a case where, because they were concerned that it might adversely affect the availability of the application, but that exposed the network to a certain amount of risk because those vulnerability assessments were not being conducted and the results of those assessments followed up on.
But when you say the agency, you mean DEED.
DEED, yeah, because in this particular instance, Madam Chair, we're not segregating the servers that support just the UI system, but the servers throughout the agency as a whole.
Okay. Representative Kiff, do you have something? Oh, no.
Yes. Okay. Well, somewhat, Madam Chair, whether it's now or a little bit later. As I read through the other audit report, there is a response from the Office of Enterprise Technology in regards to MMB and their effort of working together. And then I was looking at that finding two, and it seems as though the OET was conducting monthly external scans statewide, and there are some issues there and some concerns. So it looks like they're trying, but as I think was stated before, that they are very complex, it is very large. What I would hope that you would be seeing is progress. I mean, are we seeing measurable progress towards this?
Madam Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, OET is performing external scans, which I'm sure they can speak to, external scans of all agencies of publicly accessible devices at the state of Minnesota. What we are referring to here in finding two is actually the scans of these internal systems. These are the ones that are not accessible via the internet. And to address your concern about the scans that OET was performing externally, they did have some vulnerabilities that they had not resolved in a timely manner, but I know they have made progress on that, and they will speak to that when they have the opportunity to address the committee. Okay, continuing with finding three, this is a very systemic finding. It starts on page 7. Almost every layer, so when I indicated in my introduction about the different layers of devices that we looked at, and nearly every layer of device at DEED, we had found some failure to define what needed to be audited, what needed to be reviewed, by whom, and what action needed to be taken by it. In many instances, we saw cases where devices were using the auditing, the logging features as were shipped by the vendor, so they hadn't taken the time or opportunity to look at what events that the devices could log and if it was appropriate for their department and their agency. And the recommendation on page 8, the first recommendation really speaks to the point of it, that the department really needs to assess its monitoring needs and determine the events that needed to be logged. That was really the heart of that one. Finding 4 on page 9, where we indicated that there should be really two points in the network where risk assessments are conducted at the very least, which would be the firewall, which is the first layer of defense between the internal network and the public. And the last layer being the database. This is the last controls that we have over our data. We found that there were various findings related to the fact that risk assessments hadn't been done. They have a large amount of data. They have tremendous reliance on their developers. And so they had opportunities where the developers had some access to production that we would consider excessive. And this is also an instance where the agency thought that there were controls that were operating effectively in regards to an administrative account, and so they believed that that was being properly controlled, and per our review, we found out that the password to this account was posted in clear text and accessible to a certain subset. About 30 people had access to that unencrypted password on the mainframe. So this would be a case where this is where our review becomes very clear. And I know a lot of people would identify in finding one where they hadn't, that a lot of their control weaknesses were related to a lack of documentation. Well, here's a classic case. If you had identified what your requirements were, documented it, and gotten consensus over the process, maybe this weakness could have been exposed. But it is a very complex application. I'm sure they will speak to some of the needs as to why some of that access exists. And finding 5 on page 10, this is a fairly common finding regarding the firewall. And I'm really not going to speak to it too much, except to say that in many instances when we do find this at agencies, it doesn't require capital to resolve. Merely spending the time to go through the rule base and documenting the needs for the rules and establishing a process is sufficient. It's one of those findings that doesn't require additional monies unless they need to replace their firewall in total. Finding 6 on page 12 was very similar to logging. We found in many instances where password controls had not been changed from the default. I do want to call attention to the fact that we did not assess their general network logins. This would be as an employee of Deed, what I would do to access their network resources, this is only for the devices that sit within the UI program. They had not changed their password parameters from the vendor supplied default. And when we asked them about that, that was because these servers were configured by the vendor that developed the application, and they didn't want to make changes to the defaults because they were afraid that there might be availability issues. If they were to change something, maybe it would affect the system in an adverse way. Finding 7 on page 12, this is a publicly accessible application, and it is accessed by every employer at the state of Minnesota, and obviously the recipients and applicants. And in fact, during this development process, this is the only way, and the telephone system are the only ways citizens of the state of Minnesota can apply for unemployment insurance. So it's one single point of failure. And therefore, we would assert that security is very, very, very important on an external facing application of this magnitude. And they could have improved their procedures to make sure that security actually was a priority, especially since an external party had developed the code, and now they had to be in the process or in the position to support that code. Finally, on finding 8, page 13, this is about a $45 million application, and it increased employee dependence on this application in order to do their work and process unemployment claims here at the state of Minnesota. It consolidated a few of their applications. And it's, again, like I said, it's the only avenue for citizens of Minnesota to submit their claims. But continuity of operations was not funded as a part of the project. So we have an application with high availability requirements, but at the time and a part of the project, continuity of operations was not considered. So they've had to do it now that the application is in production.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Were you finished, or okay? If I could, a series of questions, Madam Chair. So the scope of this was just security; it wasn't the broader IT controls environment. Is that right?
We did to a limited extent. So to the Madam Chair and the Representative Sanders, we did assess policies as they might have applied to the UI program. So we did look at some broader IT controls in the context of how it might govern the UI system, but we did not explicitly look at all general IT controls at Deed.
So no software development lifecycle or other?
We did, Madam Chair and Representative, we did to the extent of that we could determine that they didn't have documented procedures. So in that finding, which finding is that? In finding 7, page 12.
Very good. Madam Chair, one more. So the underlying technology platform, everything I see in here seems to imply that it's really just a bit of a laxity around kind of process and procedure controls, and one could argue maybe they're coming out of the back end of a big long implementation and massive change in their department around this system, and so they just haven't gotten caught up on good controls. But is there any sense that just from a more fundamental perspective that the underlying technology and the platform and the things they have in place compromise their ability to implement this, or is this really truly just their procedures?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, that's an excellent question. I think if I understand it correctly, you're basically saying once this application has been in production and it was under the purview of an external party, to what extent do we have these findings because they hadn't defined the requirements in the first place? If they had defined requirements, those would have been something that they would have agreed with their external developer in this instance, and then therefore would have had to comply with those requirements, but they did not have any at that time, and we still have these security issues.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, I think Representative Downey, what we have here is what we see quite often, and that is we have a high demand for serving the public in a very open and 7 days a week, 24 hours a day kind of way, with particularly the UI system in a very difficult economic environment. So you have a programmatic push within the department to get this done, get it completed. And we understand that that's the first thing that people see and want is the service. And I guess added to that in the particular dynamic here is that there has been a significant amount of turnover among high managers in the department, specifically related to security. So, I mean, I think we all face, when we hear these things, what are we supposed to be left with? I mean, there are mitigating factors that can tell you to have some sympathy and understanding for the department and what they're dealing with. But then on the other hand, you can look at this and say, we're really at risk. We're at high risk because we didn't pay enough attention to some of the security issues that have been addressed. So I don't know where that leaves you, but I mean, it leaves us certainly thinking that there is a lot of remedial work that needs to be done. And I think this report, our findings and recommendations, are a good guide for that.
If I could, Madam Chair, and I don't mean to dominate the time, but I'm trying to really isolate where the main problem is.
You know, we may finish on Tuesday instead of today, but we do need to get to let Deed say something, and I think OET say something, even if we delay looking at the next report until Tuesday. So,
thank you for the chance to just keep going. So what I was really trying to get at is if the department pays attention and builds good procedures, there's nothing fundamentally weak about their technical architecture, their security software, their firewalls. I mean, they can get there if the attention is applied, and I think the answer I'm hearing is yes. And so then a secondary question, so if this exists kind of down in the security layer, I'm guessing, and I don't want to guess, but so one might also assume that in terms of their broader application controls and just their basic physical security and those things, that there might also be gaps, which frankly is where the real security, in my own experience, is where the real security breaches occur. Somebody takes their laptop and it gets stolen out of their car, or you know, somebody leaves a report laying around, or whatever. Did you look at the other higher level process controls and kind of broader application controls to give us any sense of security that it's tighter there, or did you see evidence that it isn't tight there as well, or what can we learn from your activities there about the broader operation?
Madam Chair, Representative, we did look at controls over the encryption of their laptops, and they were fully encrypting and also using CompuTrace, which is in the event that a laptop is stolen, they can effectively disable that the laptop is not even bootable. They do have some older laptops that they're in the process of rotating into that cycle, but they had considered the encryption, fully encrypted laptops. We did not look at the business security because what we are looking at is effectively, they did put thought into the business controls and the security of the application at that layer. We are more concerned about what are the ways that you can circumvent those layers of security that are built on the application and go directly to the data and obtain that information there. So kind of their best laid plans, even on the business logic, what could they do to completely circumvent all controls that they put at that layer?
And Madam Chair, again, if I could just add, I mean, one of the things we're trying to do, and there are people obviously within the department, again, whose primary focus is security, is to prevent things from happening. And you know, you often get the agency saying, well, nothing really terrible has happened, so what is the problem? We're trying to prevent that. And so, again, it is a matter, as I think you're suggesting, have they gotten the message? Are they paying attention? Are they going to address these issues? And they're here. They can tell you in their own words, and you can make your own judgment as to whether or not things are going to get better.
But let me say right now that we're not going to look at the second. We don't think we can do the second report in 15 minutes, so we're not going to look at the second report at all today. So we can go on, but I would like to have both Deed and OE. Ooh. Representative Kiffmeyer. I would like to have both Deed and OET able to give us a little response to this, but again, we can continue it also on Tuesday. So,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I think the couple things that you had mentioned, Mr. Nobles, were really good. And since they're going to come down, I think the question I have, do they have the tools and do they have the staff and they're not using them versus there's a lack of tools and a lack of staff? Those are two different kinds of approaches to go at it. So I'm hoping that when OET comes down that they can just add that to, and they may cover it already.
Madam Chair, my name is Henry May. I am the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I'm here at your pleasure to answer questions about this report or any other questions you have about security.
I don't know if we have specific questions, except how did this all happen?
Well, I think it's fair to say a couple of things. First and foremost, the point Mr. Nobles made right before you left, we would assert that there have not been breaches, there has not been a loss of data, there's not been employer data or private data on individuals that's been lost in the system, and we're quite confident of that. We're also quite confident that, having said that, that that's not necessary and sufficient to continue to assure the reliability of the system, and that this report really provides an outline for a good start. I would add that were we to invest and fully meet the issues outlined in this report and rest on that and continue or cease to continue with further activity, that we would probably find ourselves in the same position within 2 years again of having an unfavorable audit report. So we recognize this. We take this very, very seriously. We recognize that this is an awesome responsibility that we have to maintain the integrity of the system, the operation of the system, make sure that people are getting paid, and make sure that the information is safe and secure. And it's something that we are, as I say, are taking very seriously and working on and continuing to work on. I think Mr. Nobles cited some of the priorities that we were faced with the system. We were working with an outside vendor. We had extreme time pressures. And the name of the game at the time really was to implement a system and get it up and operating and providing benefits to the citizens and a streamlined process of operation to employers who get into that. That doesn't obviously belay the importance of security. And it's something that we have to continue to focus on. We are, and I probably defer to Mr. Boozy, but we do work extensively with the Office of Enterprise Technology. It's really a hand-in-glove relationship with them with respect to establishing standards, establishing policy, process, and procedure to assure the safety and integrity of state information systems. Within the department, we also take a holistic view of what this security is. We are very closely aligned with the people in the department that provide for physical security, things like badge access, physical access to computers, rooms, and whatnot, as well as the people who work with the data practices. And so this cybersecurity that I'm personally responsible for is very intricately linked with other aspects of physical security and the information security, so that we have a comprehensive security posture and program to keep our systems operating properly.
Do other departments have someone in your position, a director of cybersecurity, or whatever your name is?
Madam Chair, I'm actually the Chief Information Officer, and the CISO, or Chief Information Security Officer, works for me. And most agencies do have somebody in that position, yes.
Do you ever talk to each other?
On a regular basis, yes.
Oh, okay. What does on a regular basis mean? Daily, monthly?
The CIOs meet at least monthly. The CISOs, the Chief Information Security Officers, meet in a facilitated a conference at least monthly, and we have opportunities to meet more often on specific issues related to information systems, whether they're internal or statewide systems like Semaphore or what have you.
Okay. So, is there a need for you all to be in separate departments? Could one CIO or CISO, whatever they are, could they cover several departments?
I think that, again, this is my opinion. Mr. Boosie may have a different opinion. I think that there are things, there are responsibilities that we each have to tackle. There are things that are unique to each of the individual agencies and each of the individual agency systems that would be difficult to administer to from a statewide perspective. There are other things that that Mr. Boosie and OET are working on that we can get a lot more leverage if we pool our resources and work from that perspective. And so I see that we both have responsibility, and I think that it's important that we both work on them to really kind of cover the gamut of what needs to be dealt with.
Any questions or other comments from anybody?
I just want to make a good comment here. I'm sure this is a real challenge to have these kind of things and deal with this. And I know, especially right now with the unemployment situation, the volume, I'm sure, and the issues that were also there that provided something extra. And I'm sure also that, you know, internet-based and doing some of these things, when you change that sort of thing, that is a huge change. So I know that many people have commented, and in our business area, that the simplicity of doing the internet, while it was a change at first, they have appreciated not having the paper, not having the storage. There are a lot of good things that the businesses have benefited from at having this kind of a system being implemented. And I think I do hear, and I do have confidence that you do, and that what Mr. Nobles and his office has laid out here for you will be a helpful tool. And I think that I'm grateful that we've not had any incidents, and that's good, and it sounds like some of your other things that you've wrapped around it have been helpful. But I think, nonetheless, as we go forward, we really know that hackers are always out there. There's always those opportunities to try and do that. So I'm confident you will proceed further, and we'll look forward to seeing that significant improvement in the future.
We will. Thank you, Representative. Sure.
Thank you. Yes, sir, would you like to
comment? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm chief legal counsel for the unemployment insurance program, and I'd just like to say on behalf of the program itself, which is a division of the agency, that we are absolutely committed to the security of the data that we collect. We collect a huge amount of data. We collect 2.6 million wage records every quarter. We collect currently over $1 billion in unemployment insurance taxes. We paid $2.8 billion in unemployment benefits in 2009. We are absolutely committed to ensuring that that is done properly and securely.
Okay. Any other comments? I guess it's OET's turn. Mr. Boosie. Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Boosie. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start by thanking all of you for giving us the opportunity to testify on this topic. It's actually something, it's a very important issue, as Mr. Nobles alluded to. But before I move into my, I guess, official response to the issues, I think something that's really important for us to do is talk about the audits themselves. And we are involved in the process. And when I look at the deed audits, the findings in that audit, as well as the Semaphore audit, the MSRS audit before that, the small agency audit, the COOP audit, all of these IT audits that are happening today, the findings in the audits are spot on. I can't think of a single instance where I disagreed with the findings. So I think that's really an important thing. That I'm not going to come up here and defend what's happening and try and discredit the reports, because the reports are completely accurate. So that's the first thing that I think is important to put on the table.
Spoken very well as the former employee of the legislative auditor's office. We always noted the executive branch ripping off the people who are really good there, so.
But with Madam Chair, committee members, but with that said, I think there's really one important thing that I also wanted to point out is that though I agree with the issues and the findings, I don't necessarily agree with the recommendations. And so the question is, we have the issues, what are we going to do about them? How are we going to fix the issues that are out there today? That's where we have some disagreement. If you sit back as policymakers and you look at these reports, the thing that you have to just walk away with and say, boy, we have big, giant agencies here, and they are struggling with security. I mean, our conclusion is that security is inadequate for major government computer systems. So the big agencies are struggling. You go back and you look at your small agency audits, and the problem there is even worse. So these are remnants. Yet when you say, well, why is this happening, they're really remnants of some big underlying problems that we have here. First of all, when you think about this as the perfect storm, you know, 10 years ago, there weren't IT audits because there really weren't threats in this area. But as everybody reads the news, the threats are multiplying at an astounding rate. In fact, if you look at the Wall Street Journal today, two of the top three stories on the front page of the Wall Street Journal deal with major cyber incidents, things that happened to big companies with big budgets, where these folks didn't even know what was happening to them. They thought they were safe. So the threats are compounding. At the same time, what you see in our environment is we have an environment that's incredibly difficult to secure with 38 individual agencies, all these different data centers. And I remember the last time when I was on the legislative side and Senator Rest asked me to testify before the Audit Commission, one of the things we said about the environment is we're trying to do everything everywhere, and that's just really tough in today's environment.
So if you had one data center instead of all these different data centers, would that make life easier?
All eggs in one basket would be incredibly dangerous, but certainly 38 baskets is really a tough thing for us to deal with today. And at the same time, our IT investments in security certainly have not kept pace with the threats and even industry standards. And you, at the end of last session, when you compromised the bill, you gave us a mandate to come back and talk about funding. And we've been working really, really hard on that. And we're going to put together not just the answers to your questions, but some really good, thoughtful work to help policymakers really understand the issues surrounding security. So that's due March 15th, yeah. And we're looking forward to coming back and talking about that in more detail.
Members, I'll point out, when I asked about weren't they supposed to be billing back stuff, our very good fiscal analyst pointed to the words in the bill, which is they're not supposed to do that. You know, you can remember that you said they should do it, but they're not supposed to do it till another biennium session. Okay. So what we're going to get is this report on March 15th.
So. Madam Chair, committee members, so that's a high-level assessment of the audits and the problem. Now, the question is, well, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to start addressing these issues? They're very big problems. But I really think the means for us to get from where we are today to where we need to be is looking at enterprise security more holistically rather than doing it agency by agency by agency. You can see the results of that approach today. By working together collectively as a government, by putting in security solutions that span government horizontally, people, processes, and tools, we can do what needs to be done in a more cost-effective manner, and more importantly, we can set a consistent bar across all 78 of the executive branch agencies that are under our purview. But I also think it's important to recognize that the problem that we have today is a really big problem, because it's going to take time to solve the problem because the IT environment is very complex. We started the Enterprise Security Program a little over 3 years ago with a blank sheet of paper without staff, and there's a very minimal security infrastructure that's in place in the government agencies today. The people, the processes, the tools, really referring to Representative Kiffmeyer's question earlier. And
when we talk about enterprise security, one thing we use one noun to talk about enterprise security, but really within that term, there's a lot of different disciplines. It's like talking about being a doctor. Starting on more of the programmatic side, we have to set risk management standards and the minimum bar for all agencies. That's the broad basis of risk management and starting the program. We also have to have ways to develop secure computer systems, make sure that we architect things correctly in the first place, that we don't build systems for critical functions that can break and then we're left holding the bag. We have to have the operational security areas in place to address the constant influx of vulnerabilities that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. We have to have monitoring technologies. You look in all of the audit reports, and there's very little monitoring at all in a day and age when we need to have absolute situational awareness. Access controls are generally weak. You read about that in all the audits. We need to address access controls systematically with identity and access management policies, standards, a framework. And moving down the line into continuity of operations, you read the report. I agree with the recommendations. So every single one of the security disciplines, we break it down into 16 chunks. There needs to be people, processes, and tools. But that's what we're doing with the Enterprise Security Program. We're one of the few states in the country now that has a strategic plan, which outlines the high-level objectives of where we need to go. And we've also developed a tactical plan. What are we going to do in this particular biennium with the resources at our disposal to make progress today? So looking at where we are today, boy, it must be tough for policymakers to get these reports time and time again. But I think the thing for you to walk away with is that we have plans in place, and I think if we stick to our plans, that will be the key to our success. Even in times of tough budget, we have to be able to make progress in this area. I know full well that that there's some tremendous budget constraints that are out there, but even in the times of tough budget constraints, we have to look at the Enterprise Security Program and we have to make progress. We certainly will not be able to get to where we need to be and where the legislative auditor sets the bar and where we also set our own bar through the NIST framework, but we need to demonstrate that we're making progress. So with that said, I'd love to take questions.
Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, I don't know what I want to say is I hear what you're saying and I understand the constraints that you're working under. But in the meantime, the state is collecting all this information and I have a problem collecting information that places people at risk. So how do we resolve that in the meantime? I'm very sensitive to this because I just received a new credit card from a company that said somewhere I was on a list where my number might have been stolen or whatever it is, and I haven't had a chance to get into depth on that. But yeah, we're asking for people to trust us, but yet we don't have the systems in place to truly guarantee that they will be protected.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think the answer to that is we have to look at the problem today and we have to recognize and accept the brutal reality that we can't solve all aspects of the problem today. But what we need to do with the resources at our disposal is use those on those areas that we consider the highest risk. And in those cases where we have point problems that are particularly risky, we need to work on those point problems. So to put that in an example form, when I came on a little over 3 years ago and started as the first CISO for our state, one of the areas that we're having a lot of problems with is loss of laptops and their devices with not public data on those devices. I believe we were the first state in the nation that adopted a policy where we are going to have full disk encryption on those kind of devices. And now, if you go back and you examine the news over the last year, you're not reading about Minnesota government agencies that are having data breach notification because lost devices. So an example of a point problem where we're addressing a high-risk area with the resources at our disposal, and also looking at more broader-based systematic problems. One of the major issues that we're facing in government computer systems is the large number of vulnerabilities, and that's why one of the first things we did with the resources at our disposal is work on invoking a program of enterprise-wide vulnerability and threat management, where we can look at all 152,000 computers that comprise our entity today, assess them regularly, try to figure out what the vulnerabilities are and remediate them before they're exploited by hackers and other adversaries that are out there. So it's all a matter of risk management and trying to say lots of problems, biggest one first, let's address those.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles, I'm going to say.
Madam Chair, I know you're running out of time, but I just wanted to address Mr. Boozy's comment, and we've discussed this. We've had very fruitful and good discussions, and I really appreciate the relationship that we have with OET and with Mr. Boozy. It remains very good.
Your kid.
I mean, I certainly understand why he is concerned about us making recommendations to individual agencies to solve these problems, because I think essentially he sees some agencies, particularly some of the smaller ones, but some of the middle-sized and maybe even big ones, that aren't going to be able to solve these problems with the resources they have. And looking at resources shrinking, I think he's saying we need to take what we have and stretch them as far as we can, and if we simply continue to try to do this on a department-by-department, agency-by-agency, we're not going to get the job done. And to the point, though, in the way we've been doing our audits, we have been doing our audits in the way state government is organized, in the way you appropriate money to those organizations to develop these systems. Mm-hmm. If you had appropriated the money to develop the deed system to Mr. Boozy, to OET, we would have criticized him, but you didn't. It was Dee's responsibility to develop that system and manage it. I think you should, and I think Mr. Boozy's suggesting that you should think about maybe putting some substance behind that mandate that you read that gives that legal responsibility to ensure security of state government overall, but that is really not the reality of what we're dealing with, because that's not the way state government is organized or the way it's funded. It's funded in a very silo basis where individual agencies go off, develop their systems, address their security issues, with OET having some involvement, but not enough. So, you know, we're going to think about how we can restructure the way we audit so it can look at things more holistically. But, you know, it has to be in reflection to the law of who's responsible. I mean, you've said the Commissioner of Deed is responsible for the UI system. So when we go in and look at the IT controls over the UI system, we're going to make those recommendations to that commissioner, recognizing that that commissioner needs to be in coordination with Mr. Boozy and OET. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I think is really interesting here is Mr. Boozy's comment that the audit findings were spot on. I mean, you're an audit entity, and so I think that's really a really tremendous value to you and OET to have that exterior entity assessing that. But I think I appreciate what you have to say in regards to how the legislature does this and how you have to respond. Absolutely understand that. But I think in the going forward, both of their comments, I think, should be well taken by this committee in how we structure funding, especially in finance committees, so that we do get a greater bang for the buck, you might say, and empower those who have the greatest degree of knowledge. And I think we're on the right track. I just looking forward to the future. But I think for us as a legislative committee, this is a challenge to us in how we write legislation and just how we fund it. So we ought to seriously take their recommendations so that we can have that effectiveness.
Good. If you note, everyone has read the governor's supplemental budget word for word. One of the things he does, and he does it in the form of a cut, which may not be the most effective way to do it, but it's what we have to work with. There's a $9 million cut to all agencies in a direction to MMB to look at coordination. And information systems are specifically, not information something, I don't know, some word in there, is specifically listed among the things that he's looking for. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really script this meeting to do exactly what I want to do, but it's kind of turned out that way. So,
it worked.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and we'll see, obviously, people back next week as we go to the Department of Management and Budget and the Office of Enterprise Technology. And since there are people from the Department of Management and Budget, we're not quite ready to take action on it, but we'd like you to discuss that recommendation from the governor.
Thank you.
Also. And thank you very much for coming. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Meeting adjourned.